I'm going to tell you a little bit about real snails as well. Please stop me at any point if you have questions. So I deliberately made my talk less than an hour to have time for that. So I promise I won't run over even if you interrupt me a lot. Okay, so building a better snail. So I'll actually start with the first question. If you see a title like this, the first question you should be asking yourself is why on earth would you want to build a snail in the first place, right? Because, so as you can probably notice, if you think about snails, snails have a lot of problems associated with them, right? So here are some of the problems associated with snails. Snails are slow. They are also extremely inefficient, as I'll show you later on. And the worst thing about snails is wherever they go, they leave a trail of slime behind them. Right, so if I'm an engineer and I want to build some kind of a crawling device, you might not necessarily think that emulating a snail is the best thing to do. But here are the things that are good about snails. So snails have a couple of things going for them. The first is that they only have one foot, so a snail looks roughly like this. And since they have only one foot, they're mechanically simple and they're extremely stable. So you don't have to worry about a lot of the controls issues that you might have to worry about if you were building a more complex organism, things like balance and coordination, that sort of thing. But the thing that I like best about snails is that they can navigate very extremely complex topographies. So if I put a snail on the ground, it'll crawl along the ground until it hits the back wall there, and then it'll crawl straight up the back wall, and then when it hits the ceiling, it'll flip over and crawl across the ceiling. So the idea is, wouldn't it be great if we could build a mechanical device that had the same kind of versatility that these snails have? And just to illustrate this, this kind of versatility, this is a time series that I found online from this group. Of a snail that's crawling over the sharp edge of a razor blade. So you can see that the snail can deform its foot to these very extreme kinds of topographies. And I'm assured that no snails were injured in this experiment. So they really can do this. Okay, so we think of these guys as sort of nature's ultimate all-terrain vehicle. And one of the things that I find interesting about this is that to understand how these guys crawl, it's really a fluids question. Because the way a snail crawls is it secretes a thin film of fluid between the foot and the substrate. And the only way that the foot interacts with the substrate is by generating stresses in this fluid. So in order to understand how this is generating locomotion, you have to understand the stresses that are generated in this thin film. Okay, so how are the stresses generated? So here's a movie of a snail crawling up a plate of glass. So you're looking through the plate of glass, through the thin film, to the bottom of the snail's foot. And what you can see pretty clearly in this, I hope, is that there are these waves that are propagating along the bottom of the foot. And that movie will cycle through a couple times. So if you stare at this movie for a little while, you'll notice that it looks extremely strange. Mm-hmm. Right? And the reason it looks strange, exactly, is that the waves are going in the wrong direction. Right? If this thing was going to be doing something like tractor treading, the waves should be going backwards while it goes forwards. Okay, so that's the first puzzle to understand. And biologists have known this for many, many years, almost 100 years now. This was the earliest reference we could find by Blaise. And Blaise did a study on a bunch of different snails where he basically classified the different types of motion that they use. There's four main kinds of categories. The first is monotaxic versus ditaxic. So a monotaxic wave basically means there's one wave that spans, that goes across almost the entire foot. A ditaxic wave is one where you have alternating waves that go halfway across. So you'd have one there, one there, one there. So it would look like sort of little feet on the bottom. In this talk, I'm only going to think about monotaxic waves.
Can I ask you, what's touching the glass there? Is it the dark bands or the light bands?
So neither of them are actually touching the glass. There's a thin film of fluid between the snail and the glass in all spots. Yes.
Yeah.
So it does. It swims on top of this layer. But I will tell you this, if you look at the, let's see which ones are dark and which are light. So there's these thinner bands. If I put a bunch of beads in this, and I'll show you some movies of that later, the beads in this dark region are basically stationary, and the beads in these lighter regions are pushed along with the flow. So that's actually...
Just what is the topology of that? The white bands coming out or the dark bands?
So the answer is that we don't know. And the reason is that there's very little difference in the height between them. What you're really seeing is regions of compression in the bottom of the snail's foot. That's what's changing the color. We've tried to do some interferometry measurements by just shining a laser and looking at the film thickness. And it turns out that the bottom of a snail's foot is not very reflective. So we couldn't actually get very good measurements on that. What I can tell you is that the film thickness tends to be on the order of 10 to 20 microns. So I can give you some rough estimates, and you can't really distinguish between the light and the dark regions. Yeah. Yeah, so good. So let's see. So we have monotaxic versus ditaxic. And then we also have retrograde versus direct. And this is going to be one of the most important distinctions in this talk. So a retrograde wave is one in which the wave moves opposite to the direction of motion. So the wave will be going backwards while the snail moves forwards. A direct wave is one in which the wave moves in the same direction of motion. So that's, these guys are the direct waves. So stamp that in your brain, because those are two terms I'm going to use throughout the rest of the talk, is retrograde and direct. There are also more unusual modes of locomotion that some snails use. This one was brought to my attention by one of my alert colleagues who sent me this article that appeared actually in the Guardian Weekly. So the Guardian Weekly had a letter sent in asking, can snails hop? And the answer is yes, surprisingly. There is something known as the dromedary jumping slug, which I will not talk about in this talk. If anybody knows where I can find a movie of the dromedary jumping slug, please let me know. The other unusual mode of locomotion that snails sometimes employ is galloping. So if you sneak up on a snail and startle it, it may do something like this, which is called galloping, to get away quickly. I will also not talk about that in this talk. I'm going to focus exclusively on the retrograde and direct waves. Okay, so a little more history on what people know about snails. So Blaise, I've already talked about, this was almost 100 years ago, in which he classified the different types of motion. And I should say that there's actually been a lot of work in the biology community on how snails move, and I'm sort of going to emphasize these three studies, this one because it seems to be one of the first. This one I particularly like because it's one of the first studies in which people started to think about snails as mechanical objects. So Lissman actually drew these sorts of force diagrams, and he made some deductions about what had to be true about the motion in order to break the symmetry in the problem and have the snail move forward. So he had a couple of nice papers in the 40s. And then more recently, another 40 years later, Mark Denny has done some great, great work, particularly on the rheology of the snail mucus. And one of the things that he did is he actually harvested snail mucus and put it in a rheometer to look at the properties. And he found that it had a finite yield stress, which means that basically if I take a blob of snail mucus and I push on it a little bit, the thing doesn't yield. It basically acts like an elastic solid. But if I exceed some critical yield stress, the thing will start to flow. Okay. So this is actually kind of a puzzling thing, because if you think about what other kinds of materials have these finite yield stresses, the things that have finite yield stresses tend to be adhesives. Right? That's basically what a post-it note does, is you have some, you stick it on the wall, and if you exceed a finite yield stress, you can peel it off again. Okay, so that led Mark Denny to ask the following question, which is, how can an animal with only 1 foot walk on glue? Because if you think about it, it's a very strange geometry if you're going to use adhesion to move. Okay, so that's a question I'm going to answer later on. First, I'm going to answer a simpler question, which is, let's suppose I only have 1 foot, and let's suppose I only have a very simple fluid. Can I actually crawl under those circumstances? So I'm going to think about this kind of a picture. And let me tell you right off the bat that this is not how real snails move. This is more of an exercise of what is the simplest system that you could imagine. Okay, so let's suppose I have some kind of snail or some kind of a crawler, and this is the foot. And let's say that I can deform my foot in some way, like this. And that I have a fluid here and I have a substrate here, and I drive a wave in the foot, so the wave is going in this direction. So am I going to get propulsion from this? And the answer is yes. It's actually fairly easy to see. As this wave moves in this direction, you see that the fluid over here is going to be squeezed into this tiny gap, which means that you're going to get a high pressure on this side. Right? Conversely, this stuff here is opening out into this big area over here, so you're going to get a low pressure on this side of the bump. Right? So you get something that looks like this. You get a high pressure here. You get a low pressure here. Those things act normal to the interface, so you get forces that look like that, which is going to drive locomotion in this direction. Okay, so that is basically a retrograde wave, right? Because you can see the wave is moving this direction and the snail is moving this direction.
Isn't the boundary slipping?
The boundary? Which boundary?
Well, between the snail and the fluid, isn't that a slip?
No, it's actually no slip. I mean, because this is just, so imagine I'll show you in the next slide, but we built this, right? So you just have some kind of a solid device that moves this solid boundary up and down. And so you have a no-slip condition between the foot and the sand, the water.
Okay.
I'll show you. We have the experiment. So yeah.
What about the viscous forces?
Yes, so the viscous forces. Yes, so exactly. So you have a pressure that's going to push you in this direction, and you have a viscous drag that's going to resist that motion. So in fact, if this guy is moving in steady state, the force balance is basically that this pressure pushes you this way, and the velocity is selected by whatever viscous drag can balance those two exactly. That's exactly right. Yeah?
Fourier's theory, but how the snail really look like? Do they have many nanostructures like Geico?
Oh, yeah. No, actually, so the snail foot is not like the gecko foot. So it doesn't have this highly corrugated surface, right? There's nothing special about the underside of the snail foot. All of the adhesion is not coming from the surface properties of the foot. It's actually coming from the material properties of the fluid. So it's a very different system from the gecko. Yeah. Yeah.
So do we have surface tension effects?
So there's not really a free surface in the way I've drawn this, right? Because this is a solid in contact with the fluid. This is a solid in contact with the fluid. The only place you might see surface tension is sort of at the ends where the fluid is squeezed out, which is a small area compared to the rest of this. You know, remember this gap thickness is 10 microns, right? And the snail is, well, you know how big the snail is, it's this big, right?
Yeah. No, but yeah. There is a surface energy associated with.
Yes, there is. So there is an elastic energy that's between this, right? But I would argue, and so we've done the calculation including the elastic energy as well, and it turns out that that's small compared to the muscular forces that are
driving. I assume it was
right.
Small, but.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So what that does do is it does set a length scale, right? So you can't deform this at a very, very tiny length scale because then the elastic energy becomes important. Yeah. Yeah.
So this one of the things that the fluid doesn't happen is to eat it.
Yeah.
The snail has to generate the fluid, right?
Yes.
So the generation of that fluid,
yes,
as it moves, does that also play an important role on the fluid?
Yes. So I would say, so in this picture that I have right now, I'm assuming the fluid is down just to sort of look at the fundamental force balance. But you'll see later on in the talk, I will talk about fluid generation and the role that that plays as well. Yeah.
If you're in this picture, I want to go back to your explanation for why the plane moves to the right. If you imagine the snail is not moving.
Yeah.
But the wave is still, sort of the top part is fixed.
Yes, glue this guy down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the wave still goes from left to right.
Yes.
From right to left.
Yes.
So you mentioned that the fluid gets pumped, you know, under the gap from the high pressure region,
yes,
to the low pressure region.
Yes.
So that seems to suggest to me that it will, you know, move the bottom wall to the right.
The bottom wall to the right.
If the fluid is going from left to right, from high pressure to low pressure, it would tend to drag this green, let's say, piece of glass to the right, you
know? So now I'm going to have to get this right. So, let me say that I'm, certainly if I fix this, and this is allowed to move, then these guys, then the pressure is going to push it that way, right? I mean, right, but there's this other argument you can make.
The pressure actually that you generate here is to overcome the viscous,
yeah,
the viscous resistance in the tank gap.
Yes.
By
lubrication. Yes. Exactly.
So
exactly.
Pressure and viscosity are one determines the other.
Correct. 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 That's exactly right. But let me just also make a comment on what you said, because the reason I've written peristaltic pump here is that this is exactly how a peristaltic pump works, right? So the snail is basically, so if the snail is a pump, then you nail down the snail, you nail down the bottom, and then you can pump fluid, right, using this mechanism.
Okay, and that the fluid you're actually
and the pumping
right to
exactly
left,
exactly correct. The fluid gets pumped in that direction, right? So it is consistent. Yeah, good. Yeah, so basically this is a pump that you haven't nailed down. Is what the snail is. Good. Okay, so everybody understands the physical picture. Okay, so we can demonstrate that this is true by building a snail. So here's our snail. So this was built by my graduate student Brian Chan. What he did is he put a rigid helical coil in here, and then there are a series of plates that are threaded on that coil, and they're constrained to move only vertically. So as the helix turns, the plates move up and down and drive a wave in the bottom of this foot. And then you can activate this on top of a thin fluid layer, and off it goes, so it swims very nicely. So this is on a layer of glycerin, and you can see that this is a retrograde wave because the wave is moving in this direction and the snail is going in this direction, right? And one of the interesting things about this experiment is if you take this guy and you activate it on a dry surface instead of on a viscous fluid, it moves slowly in the opposite direction. So it really is using the viscous stresses to push itself forward. Okay, so we've demonstrated that it works, and we can do the calculation to calculate things about this. The calculation is fairly straightforward. So we just use a lubrication approximation. I'm not going to go through the details of the calculation because it's basically just algebra, but this is momentum balance right here in the lubrication limit. We also have to do conservation of mass, and then the last piece, which is maybe slightly different than what you normally see in lubrication, is you have to do a force balance on the foot, which is exactly what you were saying, is that we have the pressure forces which are pushing in this direction, which are balanced by the viscous drag, which is going the other direction. Yeah?
What happens if you increase the depth of the glycerol?
Yes, so what happens if we increase the depth of the glycerol? So wait, two slides and I'll show you. We've calculated that as well. Yeah?
I know that in these kinds of calculations, sort of boundary conditions at the end kind of matter. Suppose
mm-hmm.
that the
mm-hmm.
liquid had, you know, a front interface and a back
yeah.
interface, and you had a finite amount.
Yeah.
There. So
yeah.
you actually end up building a pressure gradient.
Yeah.
What do you use, you know, in this model?
So in our calculation, we just do periodic boundary conditions. So we ignore it. Which I think is okay in the experiment because our snail is fairly long, our liquid doesn't pile up because it can go up, you know, it can go off the ends of the track. And
but in the actual snail, because it generates the fluid, there is at least the front
yes.
interface.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And in fact, so I will. So the way I'm gonna weasel out of that is to tell you that real snails don't actually use this. This is something that you could use to build mechanical snails, but it'll be the second part of my talk where you'll see what a real snail does. Yeah, Marcus. That's also a great question. So it turns out that if you do the vertical force balance, if all these deformations are symmetric, you don't get any vertical force, and it just sinks to the bottom, right? And there's been some nice calculations by Jackie Ashmore and those folks on this stuff. So yes, if I was going to put my snail down, in theory, I would have to do the vertical force balance. For now, what we're going to say is that we can set the vertical height, right? Which we can do in an experiment just by putting some kind of a post or a wall here that holds it away from the interface. So the robot snail actually we activated just on top of the layer and let it sink, but there's probably some asymmetries really in the way we designed the helix, which I think is going to give us a little bit of vertical force, which is enough to keep it away from the boundary. But you're absolutely right that this is actually one of the strange things about these lubrication problems, that in order to get a vertical force, you do have to have some asymmetry in this shape. Yeah. Good. Okay, so let me tell you the answer. So if you go through and you crank through all the algebra, what you find is that you can calculate the snail velocity, and it turns out to be extremely simple, which is nice. So here's the snail velocity. The snail velocity, this is now normalized, so this is actually snail velocity normalized by the wave velocity. Okay. And the great thing about this result is that you can see that it only depends on this one parameter A. And A is defined in the following way. So A is defined in terms of these integrals. And these integrals are just integrals of the power of the shape of the foot, right? So that means that if you tell me the shape of the foot, I can tell you exactly how fast the snail goes. Okay, so now I actually have an interesting and well-defined kind of optimization question, because now you can say, okay, if I'm going to build one of these guys, what shape do I want to make my foot? Do I want to make it something like this? Or do I want to make it something like this? Or something like this. So there's lots. I mean, you can do anything you want. Guesses? Yes? No? Nobody else? Nobody's going to be bold and make a statement.
Sinusoidal.
Sinusoidal. Good guess. That's what I thought it was. Turns out it's not. That's my guess, too.
Hysteretic.
Yes and no. Yes. Yes. Actually, that's correct. That's correct. And I'll show you why. So, okay. So before we actually looked at what the real optimal shapes were, we decided to integrate some functions that we knew what they looked like, how to integrate. Okay, so the first thing we did, of course, is we did exactly what John said, is we said, oh, it's got to be sinusoidal. We'll integrate sinusoidal. So what I've plotted here, this is that normalized snail velocity. So this is V snail divided by V wave. And what I do on each of these curves is I fix a shape. So I say one of these shapes is square wave, one is sinusoidal, and I'm going to plot the amplitude. So this is actually going back to your question, which is what happens if I change the gap thickness. So I plot the amplitude of my wave. So over here, obviously the foot is completely flat, and then I pick a wave, and as I move in this direction, I change the shape of the wave, and when I get to here, I've touched down. So the wave has completely filled the gap once I get to here. Okay. So now the interesting thing about this plot, so let's look at sinusoidal. So sinusoidal is this very light curve here. I hope you can see it. So it's this guy right here. And the sinusoidal plot wave does exactly what you think it would. It goes from zero, so this is where nothing is moving. You increase the amplitude, and it goes up to one. And one, remember, this is the ratio of the snail velocity to the wave velocity. So this means that the snail is moving at the same velocity as the wave. So that's exactly what you would expect. Okay, now here's the interesting thing. If I now do something pointy, right, something that's starting to look more like a delta function, and I look at one of these curves, it comes up and it actually goes up to something like 1.5. Okay, so what I've told you is very strange, right? So, and if
well,
you think so,
that's a duplication then, though, once you start having large gradients.
Exactly, exactly. So, exactly. So, yes. So the answer is that's again exactly what I thought, that the problem is we're violating lubrication. So let me make sure everybody understands what. Oh yeah.
Is the snail velocity that you use relative to the fluid or absolute?
Absolute. Yeah, exactly.
I've lost track here. Are we in an ordinary Newtonian fluid here?
Ordinary Newtonian fluid. Just ordinary Newtonian fluid.
But
so
you're gonna expand on
that. Yes. So what I've told you here. So if the snail velocity is going faster than the wave velocity, so imagine you have a tank, and that tank is moving along because the tread is moving. And you measure the velocity of the tank. It's some tank velocity. Now I have a guy who's riding on the tank, and I measure the velocity of a tread. Okay, so that's basically the equivalent of the wave velocity. Okay, if the tank moves without slipping, right, so the tread is just going along, the tank is not slipping, that ratio has to be 1, right? 1. Okay, so that's this right here. That's the ratio. So what I've just told you is now if I take my tank, and I design the treads the right way, and I put the thing on olive oil, it will go 50% faster. So it's actually slipping forward, right? Which is a strange, strange thing. Okay, so exactly like you just suggested, I said, oh, okay, I know what's going on here. The problem is that we used a lubrication approximation, and obviously these shapes must violate the lubrication approximation because they're sharp and pointy, so I must have large gradients here.
But
so, yeah.
The thing is, you don't have something like tank treading because you only have a wave. Things only move up and down.
Things only move up and down.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
right.
It's
That's
really
right.
just, I don't think there is any violation if things move faster than the wave speed.
You are slipping forward in a way, right?
But it's not like you're dragging the bottom. You know,
it's
the bottom
true.
Just
no,
it's
true.
Down,
that's
so.
True. That's true. Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So two issues. One is it's not really a tank, and second is that we must be violating the lubrication approximation. So the problem is that as soon as things start to get interesting, our approximation breaks down. So we said, okay, well that's all right. There are lots of people who know how to do the full calculation. So we'll just ask them to do that. So we called up Mike Shelley and his postdoc John Wilkening at Curran, who have this nice code where they can actually calculate. They have a free surface and that's bendy, and they can change the shape of that, and then they calculate the fluid velocity within it. And so we said, can you please do that near a wall? Just run your code. So here's an example. So they ran their code, and so you can see this is sort of our sharpish pointy structure. And so now again, I plotted the velocity of the snail versus the amplitude, and the solid line is lubrication, and the dots are from the full Stokes calculation. So it's bang on. So it's not a problem with lubrication, it turns out. And you can argue that it's not going to be a problem with lubrication because in the following way. Basically, all of the propulsion is coming from this tiny region around here. Right? Everything that's happening out here is unimportant when it comes to pushing the thing forward, which means that as long as you get this part of the calculation right, you're OK. And lubrication gets this part of the calculation right, because that's where the gap is extremely, extremely thin. Right? So I think this effect actually really is real. And so the next thing to do is to do an experiment. So we have one of my students, Brian Chan, has I don't have results of this yet, but we've built a periodic snail where we can change the amplitude of this, and we're going to see if we can actually observe this effect. So, and then the last thing, I'll just put up one more slide on this part of the talk on optimization, which is that, so now the next question is, so what are the best shapes, right? And it turns out there are lots of best shapes. So the best you can do is that you can get it to go 50% faster. So the maximum you can make the snail is 1.5. There are many shapes that will satisfy that. That should pop up in a minute here. So these are just some things. So suppose I want, this is a shape that optimizes speed. So you get something that looks like that. This is one which optimizes efficiency. It looks very similar. And I guess I should also say, physically, this is exactly what you'd expect. So why is this what you would expect? Well, the propulsion is coming from this pressure gap across this little bump here, right? So what you would like is, you would like to have the pressure acting on a surface that is normal to your direction of motion, right? So you want this part of your foot to be as vertical as possible. What's resisting your forward motion is the viscous drag. So you want this gap to be as wide as possible, right? So you want to have shapes that are kind of wide, and then you get a pointy thing, and then wide, and then a pointy thing, right? So those are the optimal shapes. Yeah.
As far as I could tell, the velocity only depended on these three moments of these integrals.
Correct.
So if you want to optimize this thing, you want to get this thing up. How can the determination of three moments determine the entire function?
The determinant. Well, so it's not unique. I mean, so.
You said that's the optimal. There are probably many other.
There are many of them. Correct. Yes, that's correct. Yes. So these are some examples of the optimal. And in fact, even to get these, you have to put some constraints in, right? So you have to say, okay, what is the optimal shape, given I have this much foot to work with and this much fluid to work with, or something like that. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There are many, many optimal shapes.
So can I come back to this depth question? Is it really important to be in a thin gap, or if you put this buoyant swimmer on top of a thick viscous fluid, would the transport be much different?
Yeah. So the answer is quantitatively yes, it is different because. When you put it in the thin gap, you're really balancing this pressure versus the viscous drag, right? And those two are, as Ali said, those two are basically coupled, right? So everything is coming from the viscous effects because you're near the wall. You can do a similar calculation for a free swimmer, just a sheet that does this. And that was done by Taylor and Hancock in the 1950s. And you find, let me say it this way. For low amplitudes, so they did it for small oscillations. So at low amplitudes, you find that that the velocity scales like the square of the amplitude, and you see the same thing in here. So for small amplitudes, it's similar, but the coefficient is different. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're looking at how fast it goes at a given amplitude.
Yes.
Maybe that's not the right question to ask. Maybe it's how fast it goes for a given fluid flux, because as you told me, that's the most expensive part of locomotion.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And so we're going to do that calculation when we add that in the viscoelastic component. And so the only reason we didn't do it for this calculation is because, like I mentioned, real snails don't really do this. So this is more of an engineering calculation where I say, okay, I have some kind of a pipeline. I have something that's got to crawl down this pipeline. How should I design my crawler? Yeah. So in that case, we weren't really thinking about the flux as being a critical component. Yeah. But absolutely, that's going to come up. Good. Okay, I'm going to move on to a slightly different topic now. I'm going to move on to real snails. Okay, good. So that was a good segue, because this is not how real snails move. So how do real snails move? Well, mostly for terrestrial snails. Most terrestrial snails have the wave going in the same direction that these things are crawling. Okay, so how do you do that? How do you drive locomotion like that? Well, so probably the easiest way to think about it is by this analogy, and this is an analogy that's used a lot in geology and physics on the motion of dislocation. So how do you move? So the analogy is the following: how do you move a carpet? So imagine my snail is this carpet. So if you have a bunch of movers that just try to drag this thing, you lose a lot of energy because of the friction between the carpet and the floor, right? And that's not how you want to move the carpet. The way you want to move the carpet is you say, oh, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make this tiny wave of compression here, and I'm going to propagate this wave along. And as I propagate the wave along, you do something like this, and you can see that once the wave gets to the end here, your carpet has moved forward by a small amount. Right? And so you can also see that the wave is moving in the same direction of motion. Okay, so a snail can do the similar thing. So imagine this is my snail. So the snail takes its tail and it scooches up a little region of compression, and then it propagates that region of compression along, and it re-extends, and it's moved forward by some amount. Okay, the problem with this well, actually, so let me say there's good and bad things about this. I like the way they've drawn this cartoon because they drew it correctly. In that when they drew this guy, these guys moving the carpet, they drew this guy kneeling on this piece of the carpet, right? Because if you don't kneel on this piece of the carpet, it doesn't work, right? Everything just slips backwards. So in order for this thing to work, you actually have to have some mechanism where you glue this part of the carpet down and you glue this part of the carpet down, but you allow this part of the carpet to slip. Okay, and the way the snail does that is it uses this funny fluid, right? So I told you at the very beginning that people have measured the rheology of snail slime and that it has this finite yield stress property, which means that it's acting as an adhesive. Okay, so these snails, let me just put up this guy. So this part over here is the part that's glued down. So this is where the muscles are not stressing the fluid. So nothing is happening in this region. Over here, the snail muscles are stressing the fluid. They're generating some kind of a shear, and so you're driving a flow. Okay, so let me, so the material properties are crucial in this, so let me tell you a little bit about the material properties of snail mucus. I'm now telling you more than I know on this slide, because this is something that we found in the literature. So mucins, or pedal mucus, is almost all water, so it's about 97% water. And in that water you have something like 3 to 4% of these high molecular weight glycoproteins, which are mucins. Okay, and the mucins, they look like this. Roughly. So there's a mucin, and it has a sort of a rigid backbone, and then it has these useless things that come off of it. But then it's also got these guys over here, which are sort of flexible branches, which can weakly bond to each other. So you get this sort of a cross-linked network in here, which is how you get the finite yield stress property. And I'll also say that this is actually a schematic of mucin, of a human mucin. And to the best of my knowledge, people have not done the measurements with invertebrate mucins. So we're sort of assuming that they look the same, although that's sort of a big assumption because the function is completely different in human versus invertebrates because we don't use mucus to crawl. So, I mean, it's likely that the invertebrates are quite a bit different. Okay, so that's microscopically what it looks like. So what does that translate to macroscopically? So what are the macroscopic responses of these? So I have a student who has actually looked at both snail mucus and other kinds of slime simulants, because we're going to need some kind of an appropriate slime simulant if we're going to build a robotic snail. Okay. So how do you think about these things? Well, he organized it in yield stress versus viscosity after it's yielded. And so the reason these two are important properties is the yield stress, that's the thing that sticks the snail to the wall. Right? So if you want this thing to be able to climb up a vertical wall, you have to exceed some kind of a critical yield stress. So snails should be somewhere above this line, if you want things to work. The viscosity, so after the thing has yielded, what you would like is you'd like a very, very low viscosity, because you don't want to be burning up a lot of energy. Right? So you want this thing to flow very easily once the thing is gone. So ideally, you want to be somewhere up in this part of this plot. Okay, so what's in this plot? This is probably too small to read. But the triangles here are from real snails. So this is a garden snail here. This is a banana slug. And if you look very closely, so the material he found that's closest to the banana slug mucus is this guy here, which is mayonnaise. So that gives you some kind of an idea of the macroscopic properties of these things. So a couple of other things that are maybe familiar. This is vacuum grease up here. This is creamy peanut butter. And this is peanut butter made out of 100% peanuts. Which should also make you nervous, because you'll notice that the difference between creamy peanut butter and peanut butter with 100% peanuts, there's more than an order of magnitude difference in the yield stress. So they must be putting something strange in your creamy peanut butter. But anyway, So that gives you a feel for the kinds of materials we're thinking about. And again, we can do a lubrication approximation. I'm not going to go through the details of the algebra. I'm just going to give you sort of a feel for what the flow field must look like. So now, if this is my snail foot, so now I'm going to say my snail foot is flat, and I've got, this is my substrate, this is my fluid. So these are the regions where nothing is happening, right? So these are the inner wave regions, so the velocity must be zero in here. Over here, my snail foot is moving with some velocity, so it's dragging the fluid along, so you have some positive velocity over here. If I look at a flux through here, the flux is zero, which means by conservation of mass, the flux over here must also be zero, which means there must be some backflow. So you must have some velocity profile that looks something like that. Okay, so that's if the thing is Newtonian. If it's non-Newtonian, that means that if I don't exceed a critical yield stress, so here's where my stress is zero. If I don't exceed a critical yield stress, so somewhere in here, I'm not allowed to have any shear. which means that I'm going to have some region of plug flow. So my velocity profile is going to look something like this. It's going to be shearing up here. There's going to be a plug flow region and then some kind of a connecting region. So I know there are some lubrication people here, so I'll just flash up the equations without going through the details. But we basically do conservation of momentum. So we now have gradients in pressure are equal to the divergence in the stress tensor. And the stress tensor, we have to pick some form of the stress tensor. And we pick something that has a finite yield stress here. And they can also be shear thinning or shear thickening. So we put all that together. You do a bunch of algebra. I'm just going to show you that we can calculate everything you might want to know about this. So you can calculate where the yield surfaces are. You can calculate the stresses. So the important thing, though, is that you can calculate the internal stresses everywhere in the fluid, which means that I can now use these numbers to design a snail that could actually climb a wall. Right? So we did that. So here's our wall-climbing snail. So this, again, was built by my graduate student, Brian Chan. And what he decided to do is he made a discrete foot instead of a continuous foot. So the snail looks like this. It's got a bunch of little feet on it. It has some shape memory alloy wires, so when you run a current through them, they contract by about 5%, and they move the feet. And so you activate these pads in sequence. So first you move this guy, then this guy, then this guy, then this guy, then this guy. And so you can see there's a wave of compression that propagates along, and then the last thing happens, the body catches up. So let me show you a movie of our snail. It moves very slowly. I'll give you a heads up on that. It's a snail. So, hello. Maybe I'll show you a movie. The computer will talk to me. Okay, so here it is going. I'm just going to skip. This is a long movie, so I'm going to skip forward to the wall climbing bit. So here it is climbing on a wall. I promise you we didn't turn the camera sideways. It really is climbing up a wall. And so you can see the feet are active, and then the body slides forward. So, oh, and then it will also climb upside down across the ceiling. And it actually turns out that the ceiling climbing is easier than the wall climbing. And the reason ceiling climbing is easier than wall climbing is because if you stick something to a wall, gravity is both trying to pull you off the wall and it's impeding your progress. But if you stick something on a ceiling, gravity is just trying to pull you off the ceiling. It's not impeding your progress. So this is actually the easier configuration to do. So we test everything this way first.
What's it riding on?
Ah, good question. So what's it riding on? So we're actually put this on laponite, which is a suspension of clay particles in water. So you put about 3 or 4% clay particles in water, and it looks like jello. And so it's something that has a finite yield stress. The reason we chose laponite is because it was lying around the lab, so we didn't have to get anything else.
How do you spell that?
Laponite. Yeah, and I think if you ask me, I can give you the company. They'll send you free samples. Yeah. Yeah.
So back to the original robot that you had.
Yeah.
If you put it on this fluid and reverse the screw,
yeah.
Does it propel forward?
Yes, it will. It will propel forward. It cannot climb walls or climb up ceilings though. Oh, actually, that's a good question. Oh, actually, that's a good question.
Function of the amount of this fluid.
Actually, wait, you know what, I take that back. Let me think about that a little harder. So if you change the yield stress, so I think if you put it on this particular fluid, it would move forward just because the yield stress is fairly small on this. If you put it on something with a large yield stress, obviously there's going to be some transition, because if you have a zero yield stress, then it's on a solid surface and it'll go backwards. So there must be some transition where it crosses over. Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. Yeah.
Look like this kind of a robot could
mm-hmm.
just walk on dry surface as well with that kind of a gait.
Yes.
Is that true?
It does work on dry surfaces because it can use friction. Yeah.
Yeah, because I was just going to ask, are its feet actually in contact with the fluid the whole time, or is it lifting its feet out?
No, it's in contact with the fluid the whole time. We have had some problems with it delaminating, but when it, you know, if you delaminate and you're on the wall, you fall off the wall. Yeah. So
well, some of the other ones are.
Yeah. But all of, but in this case, all of them are moving just in a plane, so they just move back and forth.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
On your map of the
yield
stress versus viscosity,
yeah.
Does laponite sit compared to the real snail?
Oh yeah. So let me just show you. Laponite, it turns out, is it's a little too weak. So the laponite. Oh, do I have laponite on here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, here it is. Yeah. So these points here are lapinite. So this is 2%, 2.5%, 4%. So between 4 and 7%, you get something close to a garden snail. The problem is, though, that you can see that it is quite weak. So we had to build the snail extremely light to make it stick to the wall, which is why we used the muscle wires. We have a more recent snail that runs on a motor, and that's because we found a better fluid, which is carbapol gel. And carbapol has a yield stress that's somewhere up here. Yes.
How heavy is that snail?
Pardon me?
How heavy is that snail?
This snail is it's really light. It's a few grams. Yeah, it's very light. Yeah.
Well, I cannot understand why it doesn't fall off the ceiling. Is it? Elastic stresses in the fluid that balances the water.
It really is just that you have to exceed some kind of a critical stress in order to get this thing to flow. And if you stick this thing on the ceiling, the only stress you're applying is due to gravity, right? So you can calculate that's just mg divided by the surface area, and that's less than the critical yield stress of the fluid.
Because it's adhesive.
Yeah.
But you even get that with thin films anyway.
Yeah.
You have two glass slides together. It's quite hard to pull them apart.
Yeah, exactly. So we win that way as well. But this I think is really, we don't even exceed the stress, so it's really not going to fall off.
That's the surface tension effect, right?
No.
Or is it just the lubrication?
So it's just lubrication, yeah. Just lubrication, yeah. This way scales like H, and it's like H. One over each. So. Good. Okay, so let me forward again. So let's see. So we have. Okay, so we can build wall climbers. So the next question you might want to ask is again a question about optimization. How many people here saw Mike Brenner's talk on Wednesday? Everybody here from Mike Brenner's talk? Good. Okay. So you remember in Mike Brenner's talk, he talked about all this great stuff with ion channels. But he also started his talk with a philosophical comment about optimization in biology. And so he mentioned that people tend to do all these optimization problems, and he said there's hundreds of these papers that come out, and the shelf life of the papers is roughly about a month. So before I actually talk about optimization in biology, I feel that I have to offer a rebuttal to what Mike said. And I'll tell you that I told Mike I was going to do that, so even though he's not here, he knows that this is coming. So here we go. So here's the rebuttal to Mike's talk. And actually, I have to say that I agree with almost everything he said, with one exception. So what Mike said in his talk is, he said, well, people try to do these optimization problems. They say this is the optimal state, so biology went to that state. And that's not really the right way to think about these problems. So he pointed to this very, very nice article in Science on evolution and tinkering. So he recommended this, and I recommend it again, just to encourage you guys to look at this, because it really is a very nice article. In which the author argues that people like to think of natural selection as being compared to an engineer, where you design something, you say this is the optimal state, so this is how I'm going to build it. And the author of this article then argues that no, evolution is not like that. He says, however, if one wanted to play with a comparison, one would have to say that natural selection does not work as an engineer works. It works like a tinkerer. A tinkerer who does not know exactly what he's going to produce, but uses whatever he finds around him. Okay, and so this is when Mike threw up his hands in despair and said, well, this is a complete disaster, because how do you ask, we can ask optimization questions, but how do you ask tinkering questions? Right, so the question you need to address is, can we ask a meaningful tinkering question that says something about why the snail mucus is a view of all the way it has? Yes?
But you might not even want to optimize, but just good enough.
Exactly, exactly.
Exactly.
You take whatever you have. I have this overhead. I'm going to use that as a doorstop.
But it isn't just good enough. Is it just good enough principle?
Exactly. And it's not. It's even worse than that, because it's not even just good enough. It's just good enough based on whatever you happen to have lying around.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So the question is, can we ask a meaningful tinkering question? And I would argue that yes, in this context, one actually can.
Tinker who tinkers for a few million years is equivalent to an engineer.
It's true. I mean, it's true that in fact, actually, we can discuss this later. I think the plots Mike put up actually argue in favor of optimization. He just colored them up. but anyway, I think yes, if you wait long enough and you can sample all of face space, then you'll get to an optimal, right? The question is, I mean, all of face, you don't sample all of face space if you're a biological organism, right?
Also, the idea is not that the results, except the process itself becomes radically different. One takes millions of years, and if you're tinkering, if you're optimizing, you're achieving that much, much sooner. You're doing it without historical constraints that are present in how organisms reach.
Yeah, so I think that's true. I think there was a time scale involved. But I think you still are limited in that there are constraints that biology puts on you, which means that you can't, you can't necessarily sample all of face space. Even then, John.
Well, just the materials, have properties that allow performance functions, but that's not the only criteria. It's cost.
Exactly.
It's how much does it cost you to make
in terms
of the food you need. So there's going to be lots of optimal materials that might even be available, but they just cost you.
Exactly.
What problem is the anthropomorphic aspect? When you look at a biological creature, let's say like volvox or like a bacterial cell or a snail, as a person, you say, it's an optimization problem.
Right.
But you very often get the wrong things to optimize. Like, for example, with a swimmer cell, you think that the energy for swimming should be least or something like that, but actually it's got nothing to do with the swimming. It's got to do maybe with the food gathering or maybe something entirely, but maybe sex in the case of some of the microorganisms. So what we look at, what we think is to be optimized is not at all the thing to be optimized, and that's why it's very misleading.
Exactly, and often you have to do multiple ones at once. You have to go both swim and get food and find other organisms.
And by looking at the things, when you're swimming, you say, it's going someplace, but you may be totally off.
Right.
Exactly. To be going somewhere by accident. Right. I really want to do something.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think there are all of these issues that are connected with optimization. You have to be very careful when you ask questions about whether or not you have reached an optimal state when you're talking about this biological system. Is there another question? No. Okay. So I'm going to ask a simpler question. So first let me remind you, when we were talking about the retrograde crawlers, what we were varying was the geometry. When we talk about the direct crawlers, which are the what real snails sort of do, the whole thing that's driving the motion is the material properties of the fluid. So the thing I want to tinker with is the material properties of the fluid, not the shape of the foot. So already that's a little bit of a funny question to ask. So if I was going to do optimization, which I'm not, I'm just going to do this as a comparison. If I was going to do optimization, what I would want to ask is I would want to say, okay, if I apply some kind of a stress to this fluid, what is the response? Right. So the question I need to ask is, what is the shape of this stress versus strain rate curve that gives me the best kind of locomotion? Right. Which is a hard question to ask. I'm going to ask a similar question, which I think is more related to the tinkering aspect, which is the following. You say, okay, let's suppose I'm a very primitive snail. And as a primitive snail, I don't know how to make these very complex proteins. Right? I have sort of simple pieces that I can use. And so my mucus is something that looks very much like water. It's something that's kind of close to Newtonian. And as I evolve, I can grab other kinds of proteins, or I learn how to manufacture other proteins, and I can throw them in the mucus, and I can change the material properties away from the Newtonian. Okay? And so then you just ask the very simple question, which of those changes in material properties are beneficial to me? Okay, so I'm going to ask the following question. I'm not going to ask what shape do I want. I'm going to say, suppose I start with stress versus strain rate that is Newtonian, so that's something like water. Do I want to go in this direction, or do I want to go in this direction?
Well, you've already said it has to be shear thinning. You've already said it has to be shear thinning.
I've already said it has to be shear thinning, although... Well, I'll show you the calculation. So there's one part aspect of the calculation that's fairly surprising. So yes, so the answer is that it's going to be this. But why? So I'm going to tune the material properties of my fluid. So I'm going to think about whether or not I want to be shear thinning versus shear thickening. And I'm going to do a very simple mathematical calculation. So that's a Newtonian stress tensor where my stress is linearly proportional to my strain rate. And I'm going to say, okay, now I'm just going to do a Taylor series and I'm going to perturb around that equation. And so you say, okay, all I really care about is what is the sign of this epsilon. Okay, so if it's beneficial for me for epsilon to be positive, then I get a shear thickening fluid. If it's beneficial for epsilon to be negative, then it's a shear thinning fluid. Oh, and this is actually the most important thing. I should say that this calculation was entirely done by Eric Loga, who's a postdoc in the group. And he not only did the calculation, but he figured out the right way to ask the question.
But you can build a crawler that works in a different way that uses shear thinning.
Exactly. In fact, maybe I should put that up. Well, let me put up the cost, and then I'll draw exactly that picture. Yeah. So we can calculate these costs. So for example, so let's suppose the cost I want to minimize is the mechanical work done in crawling. So the mechanical work done in crawling, well, the muscle, if I move my muscle, what is that muscle fighting against? Well, it's fighting against the viscous stresses in the fluid, right? So the mechanical cost to move the muscle is basically equivalent to the rate of viscous dissipation in the fluid, right? That's where I'm getting.
But also internally in the muscle.
Also internally in the muscle. And so what we've assumed here is that this is going to be the larger cost. But you're right, there is another cost internally in the muscle. So that is something that we can calculate. It looks like this. You go through, you do the algebra. It's a mess, but you can do it. But the important thing is that, here's the work. This is a positive number. If you go through and you look at all these pieces, this is also a positive number. So if I want to make this as small as possible, I want epsilon to be positive. So that tells me that epsilon is positive, which means that I should have a shear thickening fluid, okay? Which we know is not right, because I've already told you that fluid is shear thinning. So we thought, okay, that's great, none of this works. But then we thought a little bit harder about it, and we said, okay, well, that's actually not the only cost in locomotion. The other cost that you have to think about is you have to think about, as people have pointed out, you have to think about the chemical cost associated with actually making this stuff, right? Because as I make more and more complex molecules, it costs me more and more energy to make the molecules, right? And so the chemical cost associated with the mucus production is going to be proportional to the flux, right? So that's just the flow of fluid. So ideally what I want, if I'm a snail, I want to set up some kind of a flow in my fluid such that I carry my mucus along with me, so I don't have to make any more, right? That's the ideal case. Is I move my foot in such a way that I drag it all with me. Okay, you can't quite do that, but you can do something close. So again, you go through this, and again, you can argue that this guy is bigger, and so that means that in order to minimize this, I want epsilon to be negative. So I want something that's shear thinning. Okay, and so which one wins? So it turns out that that biologists know the answer to this question. So one of the things that I've learned in doing this work with the snails is that biologists are amazing people who can measure just about anything that you ask them to. So they actually know the cost of locomotion, and they can take the snails and put them on little treadmills and put little respirators on them and measure the O2 consumption. And so if you actually measure how much it costs the snail to move. You can plot something like the cost of movement versus weight. So this is from a very nice paper by Mark Denny in the 1980s. And so he compared the cost of movement for slug crawling versus a bunch of other things. You see that swimming is pretty much the best. And flying is good. Running is not so good at all. But slug crawling is absolutely the worst, right? I mean, this is a logarithmic scale over here. So this is way up here. So slugs are actually, they're lousy. I mean, they're not at all efficient. So you can measure what the total cost is. B, you can estimate how much of that cost is due to the mechanical cost associated with muscles, and how much of it is due to the cost of producing the mucus. And what they tell you is that the cost is primarily associated with the mucus production, which means it should be shear thinning, which is exactly what you see in the snails. So that's good. So it all hangs together. Okay, so that's my pseudo-optimization calculation. I'm not even going to take the last 5 minutes. I'm just going to show you two more slides of things that we're currently working on. So what next? Well, so one of the things that we have not done is we haven't measured the actual flow in real snails. So our student, Randy Ewalt, has been setting up a snail micro-PIV device in which he lays down a bunch of beads and the snails crawl over them, and then we do micro-PIV on them. So this is his setup. So this is a snail on a microscope slide with a laser underneath. And you can see the snails work for cheap. If you put lettuce on there, they'll crawl for you. So that's good. So they take off. And so here's some preliminary measurements. And these are very early. But one thing you can see is that the motion is very, so the snail is crawling in this direction. And these are beads that are in the flow. And one thing that you can see is that the motion does not look like fluid flow at all. It looks elastic. Right? Let's see if I can play that again. Right, so you get this really kind of a stretching and retracting effect there. And one of the things that has not been in any of the calculations I've showed you so far is elasticity. So if I then go on and do some measurements on the this is again my when I say I mean my student Randy Ewalt does some measurements on uh, on uh, on the on the rheology of snail mucus. So basically, this is our microrheometer. So you can actually do measurements on something like, you know, sub-microliters of fluid. And you take a little bit of the snail slime and you put it between two parallel plates, and then you just oscillate the plates. So this is a large amplitude oscillatory shear experiment. And so he did the following. So he said, okay, I'm going to start off, I'm going to slowly increase the amplitude of my oscillations, and then when I get to a certain amplitude, I'm going to increase the frequency. Okay, and then when he plots that, so then he plots shear stress versus strain on this plot. So the red is where you're increasing the amplitude, the blue is where you're increasing the frequency. So if you plot stress versus strain, if this thing was purely elastic, you would expect to see a straight line that just goes back and forth, and there's no dissipation. The area enclosed in here is the energy dissipated by viscosity. So as this thing opens up more and more, you get more and more viscous. And you see some very strange behavior. So purely elastic material is a straight line, purely viscous material is an oval, and a linear viscoelastic material is a tilted oval on a plot like this. Okay, but he doesn't see anything like that. What he sees is that at very, very low amplitudes, you get something that looks like elastic behavior. So that's what we expect, right? Because there you're not really breaking the chains. But then as you increase, you get see that this curve turns up, right? Which means that your stress is increasing faster than you would expect, which means that this material is strain hardening, right? So this thing is getting harder and harder to shear as you pull up this way. And you get this very strong nonlinear behavior. So this is something that we don't understand yet, and we don't understand why this would be useful to snails, the way that they crawl. So I think the next stage is actually to put some elasticity into the models and understand how that affects the cost of locomotion. Okay, so I promised I wouldn't run over, so here are my conclusions. The most important conclusion on this slide is that real snails are complicated. And all of the models that I've done have been either with Newtonian or shear thinning or shear thickening or finite yield stress fluids, right? And we haven't done anything that has this viscoelastic component, which is clearly very important in the real snail mucus. And so that's something that we don't understand at all. And I'm just going to put up one slide of acknowledgments. The two people I really, really need to acknowledge are Brian Chan, who's a graduate student who built the robotic snails and who actually, it was his idea to start looking at snails in the first place. And postdoc Eric Logo, who did the optimization of the direct crawler and has also been really instrumental in pushing the research in different directions. So the other people up here are Gareth McKinley and our graduate student Randy Ewald, who did all the rheology. Neil Baumforth, who helped us with the non-Newtonian models. Julio Guerrero from Schlumberger, who's interested in our new experiments of moving things faster than wave speed. And John Wilkening, who optimized the retrograde crawler. Funding from these two sources. So thanks very much for your attention.